Let's start now reading through Chronicles. Like I said, the first 9 chapters are all genealogies, and all of us here, I think probably this morning, were here either last week or 3 weeks ago. So we've got a good introduction background for understanding the importance of the genealogies and also its limitations. Remember that Ezra was the likely author of 1 Chronicles, and he wrote this history of the Davidic kingdom and the kingly descendants of David, mainly about the southern kingdom of Judah. He wrote this history with a purpose after the return from exile to the promised land around 500 BC. Let's start reading. I'm going to point out a few things by chapter. First, we've got Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's 3 sons, and we've talked about that. And skipping down to Peleg in verse 19, that is, it says, "For in his day the earth was divided." That is referring to the Tower of Babel, the division of peoples with the introduction of distinct languages. That was about 100 years after Noah. And then we have Abraham, Esau, and Jacob, who was renamed by God Israel. And we talked about the importance and the way that God made that distinction, Esau and Israel, something that Paul mentions in Romans and possibly other places in the New Testament to emphasize the point that God is sovereign and he chooses of his own will. He chose to bless and to identify himself with the people of Israel, the descendants of Israel, the Israelites, as his own. But Esau is honored in this text. You could see that in verses 35 all the way to 54, so the entire rest of the first chapter, it's really the whole half of chapter 1, is all about Esau's descendants. And so It's interesting. Even though God didn't choose that line, it's important, and it's reflected in the way that the genealogies are remembered here. Going on to chapter 2, we've got listed at the beginning then the 12 sons of Israel, the Israelites, and in verse 7. Achan is mentioned specifically, the troubler of Israel who committed a trespass in the devoted thing. So this was the story in the Old Testament after the conquest of Jericho. God specifically told Joshua that everything in Jericho would be devoted to him. And this is a Hebrew word. It sounds like it's harem, and harem is devoted to destruction to God. So you destroy it as the process of devoting it to God. So the idea of the destruction is that it can belong to no one else except God because it's destroyed. So God's purpose for Jericho was harem. It would all belong to me, and it would belong to no one else. All the people that were killed, all the booty that was burned, everything valuable would be devoted to him. But Achan secretly kept some gold or silver or precious cloth and buried it in the ground under his tent. And this was identified and brought out, and the punishment that Joshua made it out for that was the execution of Achan and his family. So that's what that verse is referring to. And then we go on to David in verses 15 and 17 now. And that's what most of the book of Chronicles, 1 and 2, is about, David and his descendants. So we're starting in with David here. David being the 7th son, verse 15. Now this is really interesting. Many other people in David's close and extended family are mentioned here in this 15, 16, and 17, and you'll recognize some of these names when you read them. They're names that come up later during David's kingdom, and they're basically David's cousins. So when David formed his kingdom, all of his closest people at the top were family. The head of the army, the head, you know, scribe, the head, you know, some of the princes leading various provinces and stuff, they were actually nearly all members of David's family. And this is, I think, a fairly standard practice at the time. So it was, you pick people you could trust at the top. Going on now, we see Caleb, specifically in verses 42 to 49. Caleb is honored with a fairly long description of his family line. Caleb being with Joshua, the only two spies of the 12 that came back from the inspection of the promised land, the ones that trusted God and were faithful and tried to get the people to go along with the idea of now is the time for us to enter the promised land. We can trust God. Yes, these people look very powerful, but God is more powerful. But unfortunately, they were only two of 12, and the others were able to convince the people otherwise. And then they wandered in the desert for 40 years. And interestingly, there was a purpose in that that's not immediately obvious, I think. Caleb and Joshua were the only ones of that entire generation that survived to actually cross the Jordan and enter the promised land. That was God's purpose. Eliminate that entire generation of unfaithfulness and start over with the next one, which would be faithful. So, scribes then of Jabez, at the end of chapter 2, I'm going to come back to that later, but let's just, in verse 55, the families of the scribes who lived at Jabez, and various names are listed there. And then it says, these are the Kenites who came from Hamath. I'll tell you about that in a little bit. Verse chapter 4. All right, so now we have David in Hebron, where David's kingdom began. In Hebron, the city of Hebron. At last week, we saw some slides of the fortress that King Herod built over the mouth of the cave of Machpelah, where the patriarchs are buried. That is basically in the city of Hebron today. And this is where David began his reign as king of the Israelites. He had 6 sons by 6 wives. And then his kingdom shifted, his capital shifted to Jerusalem. And David had another son, number 10, by Bathsheba, number 7. That means wife number 7. And then in the next several more verses later, it says, and then 9 more sons by his wives. And then he had more sons by his concubines, and they're not even mentioned. So, polygamy, obviously. So, and not the only one to be practicing this among the ancient Israelites. If you were a man of position and a man of wealth, it was typical to have more than one wife. Not something, obviously, that we do today. The New Testament clearly teaches against it. And I mentioned last week that not all of the traditions of the elders, that Jesus phrase that he liked to use, criticizing the Pharisees, not all the traditions of the elders are bad or were abused. This is one of them. During the 500 years between the time of Ezra writing this and the time of Jesus, this is one of those traditions that developed. Slowly, among the leaders, the spiritual leaders themselves, according to the Mishnah, the classical rabbis passing down oral tradition during those 500 years including during the time of Jesus, and then finally written down around 200 AD in the Mishnah. It was among the classical rabbis themselves that monogamous marriage relationships began as a tradition. And then it became increasingly so over that time, until finally, by the time of Jesus, it was a very strictly followed rule. Monogamous marriage only. And then it was finally written down in the Mishnah as being tradition and what we do. But it's interesting, it just shows you how slow of a process this was. It was not, in Judaism, a formal rabbinical law until about 1000 AD, during the Middle Ages. The leader, the rabbinical leader of the Jews of Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazi Jews, was the one who finally made it a formal rabbinical law. Not until 1000 AD. So, hard to change some things. This was one of those things. Hard to change. You could probably imagine lots of reasons why this would be hard to change. So, but it's a good thing. Clearly, though, this was a rabbinical law that was supported and I would say blessed by God as being His will because of the clear teaching in the New Testament against polygamy. All right. So now let's go on to Jesus being a legal descendant. Remember, we talked about the importance of genealogies, and this is one of the key importance of genealogies. Jesus is a legal descendant, being of the line of David through adoption by Joseph. Through the line here, Solomon, and I just put dots because there's many kings in between, but you had Solomon, Hezekiah, Josiah, and then the line that goes into captivity, Jeconiah, and then that same line coming back at the time of Ezra is Zerubbabel. This is the Davidic kingdom line. God promised that Jesus would be of the Davidic kingdom line, and Jesus is legally in that line through adoption in Joseph. But he is also physically, humanly descended from that line through his mother, Mary. The genealogy of Mary explained in Luke through David's son, Nathan. So Mary was also a descendant of David through David's son, Nathan. Now let's go on to chapter 4. This begins with a description of the genealogies of each of Israel's sons, the 12 tribes. So we start with Judah, and then I think because we're talking about the region that Judah was given and settled, that we have this little side story, okay, on this guy named Jabez. So Yabetz in Hebrew, it means pain, or it's a play on words that can mean pain. And it says in verse 9, chapter 4, 9, Yabetz was more honorable than his brothers. His mother named him Yabetz, saying, "Because I bore him with sorrow." Yabetz called on the Elohim of Israel, saying, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my border. May your hand be with me, and may you keep me from evil, that I may not cause pain." Another way to translate that is that I might not be caused to me. So you'll see it translated differently. Elohim granted him that which he requested. So this is where we're going to go back to the end of chapter 2. Only two places in the Bible that name is used. Here in this verse and at the end of chapter 2. And as is often the case in ancient Israel history, place names are people names. And so they go together. And so it's very likely that this verse at the end of chapter 2 is talking about the same guy, the same guy's family. What does the end of chapter 2 say about Jabez? It says that he comes from a family of scribes and that they were Kenites. Why is that important? They were not Israelites. The Kenites were Moses' wife's family. So Moses' wife's father was a wise man who advised Moses during the desert wandering period. They were the Kenites, or became the Kenites. So it appears that we've got a little side note here that this family of Kenites has chosen to live in the area of Judah and is being blessed by God. And this man, even though he's not an Israelite, is seeking to follow God and seeking God's will for his life and asking to be blessed. And God is choosing to bless him. So we see God working, even in ancient times, among peoples, trying their best to put their faith in him, blessing them and working with them, even though they're not his chosen people. So this is not hard to understand when we understand that God is a sovereign God. He chooses. So he won't place himself into a box just because he has a chosen people. Doesn't mean that someone else on the earth who happens to have a faith that approximates something that God respects, that he can't work with that person, honor that person, bless that person. So here we have an example of that, I think. So let's go on to verse 22 and 33. Some interesting notes here. That is, in 22, Ezra makes a statement here. These records are ancient. And then in verse 33, he says, these were their settlements, and they have their genealogy. We all notice this several times in Chronicles. Ezra is referring specifically to some written records that existed at his time that he was using as references. So also, this is not surprising at all. It's just really unfortunate that those haven't survived to this day, apparently. But Ezra, it will refer to some other actual books that don't appear to be scriptural. In chapter 5, we have in verse 1, mention of the birthright as belonging to Joseph. And in ancient times, the birthright was a double portion of the father's inheritance, which would be split among the sons, but the eldest son would receive a double portion or a larger portion. That was the birthright. And by God's choosing, Reuben was not given the birthright, even though he was the eldest son. And the verse alludes to the reason here, because of sin. The way that Joseph was given the double portion birthright, do you remember the method on how that happened? Does anyone recall? How was Joseph actually given the double portion birthright? It was at that very time when he received the blessing that it happened. But I was thinking, what else happened? The key there is sons with an S. Right. But the idea there is that Israel gave an equal portion blessing to Joseph's son Manasseh and Ephraim. So instead of Joseph getting 1 of 12, he got 2 of 12, because 1 of 12 was given to Ephraim and 1 of 12 was given to Manasseh. So Joseph got the double portion birthright. If we go on to verse 2, Ezra mentions now that Judah is the one, however, that prevailed in leadership, of Israelite leadership. And it's from him in verse 2. I'll read it. For Yehuda, Judah, prevailed above his brothers, and from him came the prince. But the birthright was Joseph's. So from Judah came the prince. So right, yeah. So there was...
Where did the 12th one come from, or replace, or the 12th share?
So the Levites didn't get any land inheritance. So that's where you subtract one from, yeah. Got to keep me on my toes. There's another thing I forgot to mention about the Kenites, and I'll just throw this out as a side note because it's so interesting. Some of you may have watched Tim Mahoney's documentaries. The first one, probably the most famous, popular one, is called Patterns of Evidence, and it's about Egyptian history and the timing of the Exodus. I don't know, when did it come out? 10 years ago now? Something like that. I mean, the youth here at church watched it together once, I think, and anyway, they're very good. Well, anyway, one of his subsequent documentaries has been about Moses and Moses' role in the development of the written Hebrew language. Modern biblical critical scholars, you know, like to mess with the dates and delegitimize scripture based on dating. And he does an excellent job in the documentaries of showing how that's false. So not scripture, but, you know, modern criticism based on dates. But he proposes that in ancient history, the original development of a phonetic written language was Hebrew. It was the first, and it was Moses who developed it. So Moses had the intellect and the background from Egypt in order to do that. The original ancient Hebrew proto-Hebraic script, which looks quite different from modern Hebrew, remember that Ezra developed the modern Hebrew script at this time, 500 BC. But at the time of the kingdom period that we're reading this history about, David, they used the ancient proto-Hebraic script, which was developed by Moses. And it is partially derived from Egyptian hieroglyphics. But what's such an amazing technological advance that Moses very likely did for the world was that up to that time, the ancient languages, written languages, were not phonetic, okay? The hieroglyphics represented words and ideas, not sounds. Now, it's very similar to Chinese. The Chinese characters represent words and ideas, not sounds, okay? So the writing is not phonetic. It does not represent sounds. But Hebrew was probably the first by Moses, given to him by God, an amazing technological advance in written language to actually make a language that represented, where writing represented sounds. And it was the ancient Phoenicians who very likely got their written language from Hebrew, not the other way around. So from the ancient Phoenicians' written phonetic language, we get Greek and we get the other ancient phonetic languages of the area, Latin, and, you know, it all goes from there. But most of the spoken and written languages on the planet today are phonetic. So that was an amazing technological advance. And I think of this, it's very, very interesting that the Kenites here mentioned for Jabez, that they were a family of scribes. So what do scribes do? They work with language, right? And Moses' wife is from a family of scribes. So we get this idea from Scripture that Moses is out there herding a bunch of sheep, right? And the people he's with out there in the Sinai are just a bunch of sheep herders. But we might have that totally off. Yeah, they had sheep. Everybody had sheep. You got to eat. right? But what did they do? What was their real interest? What did they really do with their time? Maybe they're all sitting together being scribes out in the desert. Anyway, it's just interesting. Let's go on. We've got the birthright we talked about. We've got the Judah as being the tribe chosen that would, from whom the leaders would come, the prince, referring obviously to David, but also referring to our Messiah, Jesus. Then we have ending chapter 5 with Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh resettled by the Assyrians. You know, we talked about that a lot with the prophecy that we just finished with Hosea. The Assyrian comes in, conquers the northern kingdom, resettles them. And this is verse 25 and 26, chapter 5. Now, why did that happen? Verse 25 explains, they, the northern kingdom tribes, they trespassed against the Elohim of their fathers and whored after the Elohim of the peoples of the land, whom Elohim destroyed before them. Elohim is God, is Hebrew for God. So they trespassed, or they sinned against the God of their fathers, and they whored after all the gods of the peoples of the land. And then God, capital G, God, destroyed before them. And the verse is specifically talking about the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. They were the first to be conquered and taken and resettled and scattered by the Assyrians. These tribes lived on the east side of the Jordan River. So they were north and east. So kind of like east of the Sea of Galilee area is where they lived. Based on the verse 26 description of the places where they were resettled, it's interesting that Ezra says at the end of verse 26, he says they went to Chalach, Chavor, Harah, and the river of Gozan, and that they're there to this day. So remember, this day, when we're reading right here, 500 BC, approximately 500 BC. So where are those places? Well, it's a good question. There's no agreement. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go with Jacinius and what he said these places were at, because he's much better expert than I am on this kind of stuff. And Jacinius is the 17th century German scholar expert on Hebrew and Semitic languages who wrote the first complete Hebrew lexicon, which is a lexicon is a dictionary of one language into another. So he wrote the Hebrew lexicon into German. So this is the 1600s, and it's he's just hugely influential in how the Bible's been translated and how Hebrew is understood. There's obviously a lot more discovery and a lot more archaeology and everything since then. Okay, the Dead Sea Scrolls, all this has, so everything Jacinius says is not accurate, but hugely influential. Like in case you guys were wondering, you know, we know that God's name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, but why do our English Bibles say Jehovah? Who came up with that? Well, that was Jacinius. I mean, he figured, let's put some vowels in there that make sense, and it's probably three syllables, and we'll go with that. And so English Bibles have gone with that ever since. It's stuck. The problem is with the German to English, okay, J, it's never been Jehovah, okay, because J isn't in Hebrew and has never been a sound in Hebrew. It's Yah. So it could be Yehovah. It could be Jehovah, but it was never Jehovah. So anyway, but modern scholars think it's probably Yahweh, actually. It's probably a two-syllable pronunciation, Yahweh, not Jehovah. But, you know, it could be. Anyway, so that's Jacinius. Jacinius thought that this is where they were resettled. This is the Tigris and Euphrates watershed area. So it's mainly the country of Iraq. We have Syria here, we have Turkey here, and we have Iran over here. And based on this description and another description in 2 Kings that explains the same thing, Jesenius thinks they were resettled here in northeastern Syria along this river, up here in the mountains in modern-day eastern Turkey, and over here in the mountains in modern-day northwestern Iran. And Circesium is a Roman outpost. This was the farthest extent of the Roman Empire, the farthest eastern extent that the Roman Empire ever got. So it was an extremely important Roman outpost. This was basically the border. So, and Jesenius specifically says that some of these Israelites were settled on the river that came in and joined the Euphrates at Circesium. Anyway, maybe he's right, maybe he's not, but it's very interesting that the missionary that we had a couple weeks ago, remember the people that she's going to go and minister to? They believe that they were descended from the northern 10 tribes of Israel. Guess what area she's going to? Syria here. Isn't that cool? So, all these three circles here. I'm not going to say more specifically where because she didn't want us to, for the safety of the people there. I'm just saying, she's going to that area where Chronicles says they were resettled and where the people she's going to translate the Bible for, they themselves say they're descended from the northern tribes. So, yeah. All right. So 1 Chronicles 6 through 9, I'll do a quick review here. We have a description of the Levites and their role in the operation of the temple. Musicians, gatekeepers, care of the vessels, and the acquisition and care of the supplies, flour, wine, oil, incense, spices, all mentioned specifically in Chronicles, these chapters. We have the priests, and specifically the line of Zadok. The Zadok line is from Aaron, from the appropriate line of Aaron's son, designated by God to be high priest. And it was the Zadok line that supported Solomon's kingship after the death of David. It was also a Zadok line priest that supported David when he escaped from the rebellion by his son Absalom. So clearly a line blessed by God and in operating within God's will, generally speaking. Interestingly, we talked about Ezra a lot. We've talked about Ezekiel a lot as being Ezra's spiritual father and inspiration. Both Ezekiel and Ezra were Zadokite priests. All right. Benjamin is emphasized in the genealogies as being quite special and given extra emphasis. And we also have a description of the genealogies and specific peoples who returned with Ezra at the exile to populate Israel again after their captivity. So why is this important? It's probably because most of the Israelites coming back were from Judah and from Judah's line. Also from Benjamin, which was closely associated with Judah and really pretty much belonged to the southern kingdom at the time of Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple. And so they obviously also return. But there were also specifically descendants of Ephraim, Manasseh. There were Levites that came, and of course priests that came back too. So we have northern kingdom people who were taken by Nebuchadnezzar in captivity to Babylon, and then who returned, again, mostly from Judah and Benjamin, but there were here, according to the text, there were descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. There were northern kingdom people mixed in who came back. And this is easy to understand why, right? The Assyrians come and they attack the northern kingdom. They destroy it. They capture the people. They resettle them. Well, not all the people got captured. Some of them were refugees. Some of them escaped into Judah, probably with nothing but the clothes on their backs. But obviously some of that happened. All right, so now let's go on, and I mentioned this briefly last Sunday about having a discussion about separation and how important that is to God in his chosen people. And of course, we are here today because we believe that we are chosen by God. So how should we live as chosen people? It is an essential point that his chosen people separate to a degree from the sinful culture in which they live. This is the explanation Ezra gives for the destruction of the northern tribes, for their suffering and their resettlement, and their, for practical, all practical purpose, mostly disappearance from the planet as a distinct people. So this is important to God. So we're going to separate into groups and just talk really briefly about this. We'll do tables across. So if you guys could get up and just, actually, never mind. We'll do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 5 groups of discussion. So we want about 10 people in each group. So in the back corner there will be one group. In the front corner here, all the middle. So if you guys in the middle can get together at one table, that would be super great. And then we'll have the back corner there, and then we'll have the front corner here. Actually, why don't you three go over here, and that'll be more even group there. Yeah. We're having a group discussion, and I'll show you what the discussion is going to be about in a second. And then what we'll do, we won't meet back up again. We'll just end with the group discussion and go to church. So we got about 10 minutes.